Welcome, everyone, to New Polities Podcast. We are doing another episode of Good Soil with my friends, Sean and Beth. Sean, Beth.
We are happy to be back.
We are talking about milk.
Yes.
Which might sound boring, but trust me, milk is the most exciting thing that anyone interested in political theology or farming can talk about. What is milk?
Sunlight.
How's that?
Yeah, that's great. We think of milk as yesterday's sunlight going through the grass.
Yeah.
And you're drinking, for us, we're drinking it the next day. And it is the...
It's really the next day? That's the process of...
All right, absolutely. Whatever this metabolism. Yesterday. Oh, in fact, some of it is that faster than that. So if, for example, the cow should browse on a little bit of wild onion...
Right.
That will be included in your milk.
That is extremely
so. It is yesterday's sunlight, and it is one of the other things that we love. Is very few things can you harvest. When you harvest a cow for meat, it's a one-time harvest. Mm-hmm. For us, milk is a twice-a-day harvest, right, every day of the year, and
the lifetime of the cow, yeah, starting from her first calf, so the beginning of her first lactation. You can potentially harvest every day, even if you're allowing the cow periods of time when she's not lactating. For the rest of her life, you're harvesting, like, your quotidian sunlight in the form of protein, fats, and sugar. Now, the vast majority, all the life energy on the planet is sunlight. The vast majority of that is being collected on land by the thing we call grass, which is a lot of other things than grass, but includes grass. And that's where all the energy to run a planet has to come from. Mm-hmm. It's got to come from, yes, the woods participate in many important ways, but for human populations at least, what matters are grasslands. And since that's where solar energy capture happens, everything, all life, has to come back to that. The dairy animal just lets you do it very directly. Mm. You can actually trace it back very easily. And as Sean says, lets you do it in a way that goes on, you know. Every other harvest is you consume the thing and it's gone. In this case, it goes on being there.
And it's a complete food. Right. I mean, you can live...
You can live on milk.
You can live on milk.
In fact, a diet that the... Help me out with a word. The medical system north of us near Cleveland that everybody says, oh, and then I went to the
Mayo Clinic?
The Mayo Clinic. Yeah. Mayo Clinic many years ago had as sort of its last gasp curative in the case of things like tuberculosis, the milk cure. And you were sent out of the city and to live on a farm and live on a couple of gallons of milk a day and nothing else.
Wow.
For an extended period of time. And they did it because it sometimes worked.
Wow.
Not infrequently.
You know, yeah.
It's a complete food. I don't personally want to be put on the milk there.
I could do it.
Yeah,
I love milk. I absolutely love milk.
It is a complete food, which is why it's what is made for baby mammals, right?
Right, yeah.
You can actually take this little tiny mewling, puking baby mammal and grow great big mewling, puking.
No, it's incredible. And I often, like, looking at my wife and then watching child grow, it's like, it's just incredible that more of the child came from you. Like, the idea of it just, yeah, I mean, the idea of, like, the child being somehow now viable and independent outside of the womb is just so insane when you see, like, that the body of the woman is completely for the child, and the child has everything it needs. I mean, that's what they tell you.
And God gave us this food, so a land flowing with milk and honey, but he gave us this food that is this perfect food for raising children, for starting children off, and then it continues. And people who say, oh no, milk's inappropriate,
cow milk's,
yeah, I don't know what to say to people like that, because our experience, and that's all we can really talk to,
sure,
science, you know, I really want to talk to my experience. Our experience is it is the best food, not just best tasting, but it's healthy. It's
satisfying.
Yeah.
It is funny that when in a household where lots of good milk is perennially available, it comes to occupy a bigger and bigger role, even just liquid milk as a drink, a bigger and bigger role in the food economy of the household. When the refrigerator is always full of good milk, people refuel frequently during the day by going to the refrigerator and getting milk and drinking it. And we've sort of relegated it to that's a kid's drink.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't. Not when it is the product of the farm and is the milk.
And it's transformed into so many other things. And it's the basis of so much food. You know, it's in bread.
The other piece of the milk picture, which is worth visiting because the best argument you can make for milk is the most complete one, right? Well, in the complete argument, there's that sunlight shining on plant material and being collected. And, you know, it takes 56 photons to split X many CO2s and X many H2Os and link them together to make cellulose. That all happens if it happens in grasslands, and those grasslands are undisturbed by grazing animals. In most environments, that those grasslands will move either toward desert or toward forest. Mm-hmm. And we can all clap our hands and say forest is ecologically friendly, which is maybe true, but it is not human food friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Forest in general is not a good environment to go to look for your calories. Grass needs to be grazed, needs
right.
to be cut off in some way, and if it is grazed properly, it gets better.
Mm-hmm.
You build soil, or the most important part of the soil profile, which is humus, actively and almost fast enough to watch it happen, certainly fast enough to watch it happen over a period of weeks and months. You're actually making the substrate for your living systems better by living properly.
Yeah, and we see this around Steubenville because you keep teaching people to do the same thing. And so it's like, oh, I see that you have movable fences and are moving a cow here and there, you must have talked to the Dohertys sort of thing. But you said it's for your whole system, because you guys use milk not just for human consumption, right? But
it feeds the animals on the farm, it feeds the garden, it's just
how do you feed
incredible.
The garden with milk?
I will let my wife talk about that.
Well, directly, I mean, the direct answer would be
water with milk.
So with dilute milk,
mm.
for example, if you want to give a boost to some plants that you've started, or plants that you have planted, you know what a hugel mound is? Piles of logs of compost.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you plant in them. If you're starting in a situation like that, where there may be a low available fertility, you would water with a dilute form of some kind of milk. Simply, even in the big picture of dairying, there's a cow and vessels that we bring to the cow when we fill them with milk, and then we take them away and we do stuff with the milk. And what do we do with the vessels afterward? We're constantly rinsing them. There was a time when wash meant on a farm the water that came out of the dairy, and it was used to slop pigs. It was used to pour over your favorite rose bush so it wouldn't get a black spot, because as it happens, a weak solution of milk is as powerful as any anti-plant and anti-fungal available on the market. Who knew that?
I did not know that.
And it's just, it's going to be ever-present, right?
Mm-hmm.
With dilutions of milk in some way. And
yeah.
those are going to go back to the, on a farm that can't, previous to our age of flush toilets, on a
mm-hmm.
farm where effluents were going to stay there,
yeah.
right? That was one of the effluents, and it did indeed contribute to the fertility of the dad.
Yeah.
But, yeah, milk will feed everything on the farm, because milk is that renewable everyday thing that takes daily sunlight
yep.
and makes it available
yeah.
for the farm. It was a big jump for us when we realized, oh, okay, so if the crop on a farm is the the stuff that's already growing, then the actual harvesting of the crop has to happen through a thing that can take what's growing, that's default ground cover, and turn it into forms that make it available to species we like to have around us, things like tomatoes and pigs, right?
Yeah.
And milk does that.
Yeah.
It's not just, oh, that's one way to tweak the creation to get an effect you want. Grazing animals are the way that human cultures make food available to themselves in the vast majority of situations. Okay, sure, we can look to the Inuit and say, okay, they're not primarily dealing with grazing animals, but most human cultures go back to some form of cooperation with grazing animals.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, that cooperation tends to become husbandry, not just hunting.
Yeah. We're getting ready to go speak at Homesteaders of America. This is in October in Front Royal. And one of the workshops, we're going to have a whole day workshop on building the input-free farmstead. Mm. And this is something that we are finding more and more people very interested in, because they go to they get a few animals, and now I'm going to the feed store all the time in order to keep these animals alive. And they're kind of basing their whole farming on what the commercial farm does on the miniature.
Sure.
And we have abandoned that through finding that we can feed our animals from the farm. And so our cows go out and they eat this grass, and that's all free. So there's no, we don't have to go to the feed store for that. Mm-hmm. And then we take this milk, and it is the heart of, it's not the only thing that we're feeding to our other animals, but it is it's the thing that makes the input-free farm
yeah,
work.
It's very beautiful. It does seem to be analogous to the fruit of the tree, the milk of the cow, and really the milk of the animal does seem to be like, if in the pregnancy of the animal, the new individual is sort of the exterior fruit, like, well, there's the perfection, it's walking away. The interior fruit is the perfection of the female animal, which is that now she is producing life, like, in a quite literally fruit.
She's fruit
edible. Right, yeah, she has become edible. I mean, there's something a little bit savage about it, but if you've seen children at the breast, you know, they kind of are often little savages, because
small mammals that,
right,
yeah,
like
mammals.
Their mothers are food. Their mothers are food, and becoming food is, you think about the analogy of bearing fruit within the life of grace. Like, to bear fruit is not just this idle metaphor of, like, it's some pretty thing on the tree. The point is, it's an edible thing on the tree that you want. When Christ says, by their fruits you shall know them, you have this whole paradigm for judging human life itself that says, okay, how do we know that the human being is perfect? Well, it's where he becomes edible, and not edible in the sort of gross sense of cannibalism, but where does he feed others? Where is his habitual life such that the other person is nourished by him? Don't judge a man by what he gives himself, how he maintains his homeostasis, you know, judge him by the fruits.
That's right.
And it seems like within, I'm thinking of the biblical literature, that just milk is such a, you know,
it's
think
an
about
omnipresent
and
image.
Yeah. And clever, image. Right. And clever man cannot recreate honey, and it cannot recreate milk.
Yeah, and if you think about honey and milk as the signs of the promised land, they are also abundant.
Oh my gosh.
Goods that we receive akin to grace. Mm-hmm. It, like, they're good little images of grace, right? Because so I'm keeping bees, and as with most,
you're keeping bees now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah,
good.
I just have one.
Horizontal or vertical hive?
Vertical. I've heard the
yes, we're gonna work. We're gonna work on you. It's not propaganda. No, this is really the way to go. But
what I'm finding with the bees,
right,
as with almost all, almost all agricultural sort of forays that I've had the time to begin, is how little work is involved. Not how much work, but how little work. And I understand, of course, there's problem solving, but.
And in some sense, the more we get involved, the more we mess it up.
In some ways, yeah. Like, you have to tend a nature that pre-exists you, right?
That's right.
Ratzinger talks about the liturgy as the rite, especially R-I-T-E, R-I-T-E, yeah. as being that which I do not control, but which I receive.
Nice.
And so it's the relationship of man to right is a gift.
I knew there was a reason why I didn't like ad-libbing in the math.
Well, that's what he's saying. He's looking at, I mean, especially when he was writing, this is in the spirit of the liturgy, he's looking at people that are critiquing the idea of right because it's somehow stifling the creativity of the person in his worship of God. And he's making a really great argument where he's not denying the goodness of creativity at all in the worship of God. He's just saying that what makes man socially creative, is, as opposed to this sort of obsession over individual creativity that we have, is to produce something that is a response to God's gift. And that he keeps on saying unspontaneity is the essence of liturgy, or the essence of right in some ways, because something is going on without us, and that puts us in the mode of the receiver. We don't control it. It's there. It's happening. The cow is making its milk. The bee is making its honey. And when we receive these things, it's as gift. I mean, it feels like gift, even if we're working on it, because...
Oh, very much. It's like collecting eggs, you know, is the one that most quickly connect with. It's like Easter or something. But you're right. Yeah. You come to it every time as though it's dropping from heaven.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do think there's something to... I mean, I don't want to get too far into some of this maybe dubious biblical exegesis, but when you think about the manna from heaven, obviously incredible, miraculous, but also a reminder of what food is for a people who had gotten used to receiving food at the end of a production line in Egypt. Mm-hmm. What are... the Israelites complaining about, whether complaining about the vegetables that they could get within their slavery in Egypt, right? Which was presumably, you know, related to a certain rationing, like they're able to receive that as slaves, and now they're free, going away from these vegetables, which, and towards these abundant ideas, milk and honey, things that are gonna simply be received. And it just seems like God is reminding them that all food at the end of the day is like manna. I mean, it all comes from heaven. Mm-hmm. And you needed it in a spectacular fashion because you'd forgotten it, because you saw it as being at the end of a supply chain, because you were part of an empire that...
So manna really enacted for us that food is gift.
Yeah, I mean, most...
You think it's...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, okay, so where does that put us presently?
Oh, my gosh.
All people don't like food that isn't already processed and packaged. We're afraid to pick something off a tree or pick something off the ground.
Yeah.
And eat it. And so we do not... This has been our... I mean, we've had to form our thoughts, especially in teaching, around an increasing analysis of modern food ways as... people in the United States of America, in the first world today, know, if they know it at all, only abstractly and at a great deal of distance, that food is an agricultural product.
Yeah. Well, and raw milk is dangerous.
Right.
Now we always do say that the way that milk is being handled now by the big companies, it would be dangerous as raw milk. But for us, we're taking it from the cow, we're going straight to stainless steel, straight to glass.
Can you explain the process of industrial milk collection? Because I don't know that people would know. And why is it that the resulting product is one you have to boil and sterilize in order to make it fit for human consumption? Why is that?
Well, so that it's the nature of grazing ruminants, the things that we milk, right, to live outside on grass, eat, defecate, walk around, sleep out there on grasslands, and it's under those conditions that they naturally produce milk. And if we want it, we take a container out and squeeze the milk into it and then go use it in various ways. And that, roughly speaking, really was how milk was produced on farms all around the world.
And why a farm always had a milk cow. even when they were traveling on the Oregon Trail or something like that, they would keep their cow with them because it was their source of the best food.
And so that really is an image, an accurate image of how, say, my grandfather, right, in the middle of the last century, was producing milk for home consumption, a certain amount for sale.
Not how we grew up.
Right, I did not grow up that way. That's how my grandfather was producing milk.
Mm-hmm.
As a whole lot of causes drove small farmers and small farms out of the American picture, and farm methods were industrialized. Farms got bigger to pay for the industrial equipment. Bigger farms always means fewer farms because, of course, we're not making more land. So if my farm gets bigger, it's because my neighbors stop farming. And as we began concentrating all of these activities, but we'll choose cows, in one place, very quickly you get to see the limitations of animal concentration when you're looking at dairy cows, because a cow's natural way of living is to walk out and eat.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a dairy cow, it walks back and gives milk, you know, walks back to the barn, gets milk, walks out and eats, walks back and gets milk. Well, a cow's legs are only so long, and she's only going to walk just so far. So within walking distance of a dairy, there's only grass, cow walking distance, ambulatory distance.
Cow miles.
There's only just so large of an area.
Yeah.
That can hold cows and take them back to a central dairy and feed them.
Right.
And that, you know, we could apply a number, and I'll give you a rough number, say 25 to 50 cows can live in one place and still have room around them to forage if they're managed very carefully, fill their bellies, make milk, come back and get milk twice a day. And we exceeded that number. And in order to exceed that number, concentrate those animals under fewer owners and in fewer places, we began feeding them grains, which were being subsidized by the government, so it made them artificially cheap. So that was an easy way to have an easy to move, easy to store, small to feed out, concentrated food to give to these animals. The other thing that we, of course, had exceeded is the number of cows any given proprietor can hand milk. So machine milking was invented 130 years ago, but farmers didn't like it because it was clearly not that great for the cow and it didn't produce as good a product. So it didn't really catch on until we began exceeding the number of cows in one place that a man and his family could readily milk twice a day. So why is raw milk bad for you? Well, okay, the cows aren't living, I mean, raw commercially produced milk bad for you. The cows aren't living in normal conditions. They are living in conditions where pathogens aren't we don't purify the environment with sunlight and air the way we would outside.
The food they're taking in too is not the normal food.
We're feeding them food that the effect of grains on the gut of a cow are that her gut biota don't achieve as low a pH as they do if she's eating grass. And at that higher pH, pathogens like E. coli or 157H7, which is the nasty one or one of the nasty ones, can live in the gut of a cow. And since she defecates from the same end of her body that she produces milk, there's sometimes going to be some crossover. But the biggest reason that I would say, beyond even the possibility that grain feeding cows makes them more likely to carry pathogens, the biggest reason that commercially produced milk is going to be unsafe to consume in its raw form is that when we use machines to milk cows, not only do we set them up for a bunch of other physiological problems, but we take milk and we run it through silicone cups that are called inflations, through long miles of plastic pipeline, which, by the way, since they're in use pretty constantly, day in, day out, for months and months and months, and they're miles long, Can you picture to yourself disassembling this machine and reaming it out with, say, a bottle brush every time it's used? Well, you might be able to picture it, but it would take an army of people, and it doesn't happen. It's not what we do. We use this machine to move milk very fast through pipelines into big bulk tanks, pump it into tank trucks, haul it away. All of these conditions are putting milk, that most perfect food that's rather like a petri dish, and that everything wants to eat it, every pathogen wants to jump in and have a big family. We're running it through pipelines and tanks that we can't clean. Hmm. Even if we had the time, we just don't have the mechanical means of cleaning them.
So and they would try and clean them. They would try and run acid washes through, super hot water through, but you're getting a film. Anybody who's dealt with milk knows that a film develops, and you can't clean that.
Did you ever see those silly straws when you were a kid? They mm-hmm. come in your bottle. Mm-hmm. And if you ever used them to drink milk, you only did so twice.
Right, right.
At that point, you were aware that they were nasty.
Right, right.
Well, that picture, that's your
pipeline. No, I get that. System. I get that.
That is not, by the way, an entire dairy farmer.
Or silly straws.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Or silly straws. Just use them for water.
And so they came up with a solution, which is to pasteurize it.
Right.
Yeah.
So raw.
Now, but is that the order of events? I'm ignorant on this. Which came first, right?
The chicken.
Well, sure. But is the pasteurization enabled industrial farming or industrial milking, or did industrial milking necessitate pasteurization, or is it like a cross fertilizing?
Got introduced for milk. During the big urbanization boom in this country.
This is why I keep her along. She knows all of this.
Awesome.
And I don't have to memorize it.
This is fascinating history, too. Like, I was a total loser in history in school because it wasn't real to me. This is real to me. When did we begin pasteurizing milk? Well, thanks to Louis Pasteur, we have the process. We say, oh, we heated them, we kill microbes. And I'm great at forgetting exactly what decade, but think late 1800s and to early 1900s, as our cities were getting larger, they were becoming manufacturing centers of the Industrial Revolution in the way that, you know, Manchester in England was just a faint shadow of. So we had a whole lot of people squeezed into a small area, a lot of those manufacturing productions made stuff, right? So say you are running a brewery in Milwaukee. One of the side effects of that brewery is you have a whole lot of grain mash that needs to go somewhere all the time. And an easy way to sort of get a secondary income out of that and get rid of this stuff is to bring some calves into the city, park them, feed them brewer's mash, milk them, mm-hmm. and market the milk. Was a good way to get rid of brewer's mash. It was also a good way to answer the question, how, if you make a Milwaukee, do you provide milk for a Milwaukee?
Sure.
Because that issue of how far cows will walk to graze and come back and be milked comes into play. And also the issue of how far I can truck milk and have it remain sweet, as in unfermented, comes into play. And you just can't concentrate. You know, there's a limit how many human beings you can concentrate in one place pre-refrigeration and still supply them with milk. So you get these city dairies, and the food is wrong, the conditions are unhealthy, you've got a bunch of people crammed into a small city, or a big city but small space, and you're producing this highly fragile, if that's the right use of that word, extremely nutritious product that can easily be contaminated, and children were getting sick. And somebody somewhere said, what if we establish, so pasteurization becomes a known thing, and people say, there are microbes that they actually study the milk, stain it with something that would turn the little tuberculin bacilli red, and you could say, oh, it's tuberculin milk. How do you fix that? You pasteurize the milk. So they established stations in big cities like New York where women could take their milk and get it pasteurized before they fed it to their children. what I've just described is an emergency method for managing basically refugee conditions.
Totally, yeah.
And that was the only reason you pasteurized milk. Actually, even for shipping milk prior to refrigeration, pasteurization wasn't the go-to. Some weird stuff was, like, there was one point where formaldehyde was being added to milk before shipped to cities to keep it sweet, as in unfermented, for a little bit longer. But pasteurization was not a norm. And in fact, that's very evident if you go back and do your reading, because it's always referred to by the fact that it's pasteurized, whereas farm milk, country milk, is a different, it's exempt. Nobody would dream of pasteurizing it. And in fact, Pasteur is supposed to have said, when he knew that they were pasteur, I don't know if this is true, but I like it. Pasteurizing milk, he said, oh, look what they've done to my lovely milk. in French, of course. For whatever reason. So then why did we start pasteurizing milk later on?
Yeah.
Pasteurizing all milk.
All milk, yeah.
It had to do with the growth of cities.
Yep.
The fact that we were shipping milk from further and further out.
Yeah.
Now, I would be interested in, I haven't done this research, but it'd be nice to know who began the practice of requiring pasteurization.
Yeah.
Because actually, raw milk sales have been allowed all over the country for many, many years, and went out, the right to market raw milk only disappeared as the dairies who were grandfathered in as raw milk dairies, as dairies that didn't have to pasteurize, as they went out of business.
Sure.
So if the stuff was unsafe, why would you have a grandfather clause?
Right,
if
right.
It was really, if pasteurization was necessary, why would you say, well, not you, because you've been doing it a long time, you go ahead and peddle raw milk even though it's toxic. No, for whatever reason, we felt the necessity of, we corporately, our government, felt the necessity of eliminating the possibility that milk would be marketed in any good pasteurized state.
Yeah.
But pasteurization followed upon large cities, large dairies, and long distance shipping.
And for us and for our friends who are doing this, it is not necessary.
Right. Yeah, no, this is the crucial thing. I mean, what you're saying is an industrial process necessitates an industrial solution.
That's right.
And if you're not using an industrial process, it's not necessary.
Right.
It seems to be a certain law of nature that where greed exceeds, I don't mean greed in some like malicious finger wiggling way, but just in the sense of that transition moment from a desire for goods to a desire for profits, where profits are money. It seems to be this law that it turns nature to poison, because like you said, there's a limit to how much you can amass when what you're amassing is the gift of God. Right now, if you want to amass something that's totally made by man, like I don't know, Bitcoin or something, you have some expanded affinity for amassment. But amassment generally, you think nature abhors a vacuum. You should see what it does with an amassment. Detests it.
Yeah.
And so that whole principle, I think, I mean, it's in the Bible, which is just because the Bible is in some way the book of nature. You think about the story of Abraham and Lot. They're farming, and they run into this point in which they're both expanding in power and wealth. They're kind of princes of the earth, and God is blessing them abundantly, and it's very beautiful. But they do run into this problem that their shepherds are starting to fight because they're butting into each other in some way. It's a little vague exactly what's happening.
I can picture it.
You're right.
I'm watering my sheep at that spring out of the way,
Right.
Or that's where I was going to pasture my dam.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And the story that follows is very beautiful because it's not a presumption of scarcity where it's like, okay, now that we have competition for limited resources, we need to bring in technology to be able to continue this sort of amassment process without conflict. Abraham tells Lot to go choose the land that he'd like to go to. And of course, this is presuming an abundance of land, which there really was. But it also is fascinating because Abraham was in no position to give Lot the first choice. So Lot was younger. Lot was not they call him Abraham, the prince of the land, but Lot was in a lower position. Abram could have taken what mm-hmm. name he wanted, but he gives Lot.
God called Abram.
Well, sure, there's a lot of authority and power there, but it's precisely the story of Judaism and then Christianity that the strength is perfected in weakness, and you see this right here. Abraham's strength is to say to Lot, choose the land. Mm-hmm. Lot goes and chooses the best portion. He goes and chooses the land like unto Eden, it says, whereas Abraham goes the other way. And it's interesting because Lot then, of course, becomes enslaved to Sodom. But what I'm trying to get at is there's a point of growth which necessitates distribution, right? Whenever we try to amass, we run into this problem.
Well, manna as well. If they took more than they needed, went bad.
Well, that's why I say it's a remedial miracle. It's like you forgot about what, because that's true of all food.
Yes.
If I don't share, if I don't give, then I get a result, and it's called rot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because nature is too abundant for man to pretend he's an individual.
Right. Now, refrigeration and freezing has eliminated some of that again, because when my grandfather, who was a butcher, that's true too.
We're burning other things.
As a butcher, he would go out and he would help butcher an animal, and then everybody took some of it. You shared with your neighbors because you couldn't hold that much meat.
Yep.
It needed to be dispersed again, as mm-hmm. you're suggesting.
Yeah, and dispersion is it's a political phenomenon. It's like the question of, it's very perennial. It's like the decision to amass versus distribute is really the decision between the city of man and the city of God.
Yes.
When the city of God reaches any height of perfection, it moves into a mode of bearing fruit and actually distributing that strength into more people. It empowers others. It beautifies more places. It gives itself up. Mm-hmm. It's self-sacrificial by nature because it's following nature. It's saying at the very peak of perfection, it's not like the cow then further amasses for itself. No, it feeds others. And the same is true of the land, and the same is true of people and our virtues, especially. Like, we do not become courageous in the way that, say, the Stoics would have talked about becoming courageous, where you further and further immunize yourself from the world, right? Which you become essentially able to stand over and against as virtuous. You become virtuous for the sake of love. So, like, now I have become the perfect servant because I have quite literally the skills of living, the habits of life, in order to serve others. And that's that moment of distribution. City of man is the opposite. Augustine just characterizes it as a love of self. And what that means is whatever we have is for us. So we amass. And then those amassments are destroyed. And that destruction is characterized as the wrath of God. I'm not trying to say that it's not real or personal that God punishes amassments and breaks up strongholds, but I'm saying that he does it precisely through and because it's natural.
Because of the nature.
He created this order, and amassments will be destroyed.
That's right.
It's
kind of like if you keep sawing on a branch you're sitting on, nature drop you to the ground. God doesn't have to step in and
right.
make it happen.
Well, because in some way already did,
We are very concerned with the farming systems that are going on now, that at some point, as fewer and fewer farmers are farming more and more land, nothing is on a human scale anymore. It's mm-hmm. on these gigantic scales. Mm-hmm. This system's going to collapse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it won't take much.
The citizens of this nation believe that they will go on eating because the industrial food system continues to put things on the shelves, is the height of blindness. And you can only excuse that mistake by reporting that we are all in total ignorance of how our food comes to be. But we're presently dependent upon some clever fixes that have been plastered upon clever fixes, which have been plastered on clever fixes, all the way back to not a situation that needed to be fixed, but exactly the amassment you're talking about. That when we decided that we were going to farm on a scale that let us amass,
yeah,
right? And farm in ways, invent things like refrigeration that let us amass.
Yeah,
we had to continue. We knocked a hole in the boat.
Yeah,
and every patch we've put over that hole in the boat has made more holes in the boat.
Sure.
And we just keep putting patches on because those patches have enriched a small but very powerful segment of the country for decades.
Yep, yep, yep.
But our the actual natural systems, grass ends, soil that is capable of producing plants that bear fruit, those natural systems have been so undermined that we're completely dependent on those fixes, and the speed with which we can go on generating, they're not fixes, they're simply distractions from the problem, right, somehow revved, right, engines that do indeed keep putting something edible on the shelf, but there is no natural replenishment that will keep that going.
Yeah.
Indefinitely.
But the exciting thing is that you can pull out of the system and you can take a small piece of land and say, I'm going to farm the way grandpa and great grandpa farmed and find that it works. That you, in fact, are creating an abundance of food that also the land improves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a system that feeds itself.
This is not nostalgia, and this is definitely not the 1970s homesteading movement. This is not like, peace, love, and brotherhood, and let's go out in the country and live our isolated lifestyle and communing with nature. This is not that at all.
Mm-hmm.
This is the basis. Humanity's here because we did figure out for a long time some fairly decent ways of
patterns,
that's right, of managing very limited landscapes prior to only very few decades ago. Right here is all there was. Wherever you were, you weren't going anywhere else. Either you couldn't get away, or your neighbor in the next county wasn't going to let you get away. You had to take care of where you were. And we had patterns that we could observe in nature and then observe our own effects on. It let us go on producing food in the same place for centuries. That's called Europe. That's called China. That's called any place where we had long-term human occupation.
And two of the keys that we have discovered are milk, the ruminant on grass, and then careful management of the grass.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things have been the basis of how we farm that allows us to grow. I mean, we could easily grow 100% of what we eat, but
we will at some point. But
that's right.
It's unnecessary, and it's also a little bit antisocial.
Sure.
So
milk is illegal, and that's it's fascinating.
Yeah, raw milk.
I know, but there's something about saying that where it's like,
oh yes, yes.
It just seems that there's a different product that does different things,
yeah,
and we call that milk. Obviously, it's from milk, but in the same way that if I take your milk and I leave it and let it start to ferment and become a kefir, I would say, oh, this is kefir.
Right.
Because something's been done to it intentionally in order to make it a certain way. Mm-hmm. It seems like in a similar sense, if you take milk from the cow and then run it through legally enforced pasteurization for sale, to some extent, you're creating a different product that you have as much justification of saying, well, this isn't milk in the same way you would say kefir isn't milk. But what I love about your milk is that properly managed, and it doesn't take too much work, it has no waste to it. Even for human beings, I don't just mean the kind of no waste attitude we talked about with compost, where it's like you have something that is waste to your immediate transformation of the world into continued life, but it's a gift to something lower in the hierarchy. What's fascinating about milk is precisely as the fruit of creation in some way, it gives and gives and gives. So milk becomes kefir, becomes yogurt, can become cheese. And what is in pasteurized milk, just a process of it becoming undrinkable. In raw milk is a process of it becoming more valuable. And so you have two lessons, as it were, that when you mandate an industrial process, you get a sterile product, not simply in terms of its, you know, the fact that there's nothing living in it, mm-hmm. but sterile in terms of its now contracepted almost from taking on new life.
It's incapable of further fruition.
And you said briefly that all of our, you know, the term is somewhat hip, like all of our manufacturing of scarcity, mm-hmm. where we take things that are obviously, as long as we're virtuous, going to provide and provide abundantly, get rid of that virtuous part, and then start to create systems where they will no longer provide abundantly unless someone is enriched. Mm-hmm. That's the manufacture of scarcity. So in doing that with milk, it seems like we have struck a maybe esoteric or at least poetical blow at really one of the dominant metaphors for the goodness of life and the goodness of existence, or in the abundance of life, the abundance of existence, that thing that, you know, sunlight seems to tend towards, and that never really stops giving until it's well and truly gone, becomes a sterile object that we extrinsically pay various industries to turn into the precise dairy commodities that we would otherwise get with just the milk itself. So you think about yogurt. I mean, yogurt is wild because we take the milk, we then sterilize the milk, and then we get the things that we took out of the milk from somewhere else, presumably an industrial operation, I'm sure, mm-hmm. and we stick them in the milk, mm-hmm. along with, and because it doesn't achieve the result as well, we also stick guar gum and carrageenan. I don't know if I'm even saying that right. So it makes it thick. So it produces the thickness that we would expect from fermentation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels real until you start reading the label and then you're...
I'll bring you some home-produced yogurt. And
not veggie yogurt. Not veggie yogurt.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I've been eating yogurt for a while. Legally.
But man is so clever.
Yes, of
course. That he can... You know, I was horrified when we were... I think it was in Texas where we were, Dallas, and they were having this huge... conference, and they were injecting taste into the smells so that this meat was just dead, horrible stuff.
I remember it was a trade show that he went to, and it was for restaurateurs and producers, and it had to do with how do we use artificial smell and flavor to enhance the experience that the consumer is going to have this food product.
So you can take really lousy food, really bad, right, and then you inject this stuff into it, and it's really yummy.
Yeah, totally.
But that's what it is. I mean, it's totally injected.
But you can see how that creates, you know, the injection creates more markets that are capitalizable. So instead of it simplifying, it's like, well, here's a way to make money here, money there, money there.
And that's why I think that the corporations would be way behind things like manufactured meat, because then we can control it. We are independent. We can raise our own cattle. We can eat our own food.
You
can't tell us. I mean, you can try and tell us what to do, but we can. Yeah, we can give you a lot of pushback. Where if everything's out there manufactured, and I'm just at the mercy of what's coming from Kroger's, I'm yeah, in trouble.
Yeah, and this is sort of how capitalism works. You know, Marx talked about this where on a geographical level, where he said, what capitalism has to do is find new markets. And he was speaking about like going overseas, because you cannot have the process of industrial mass production and wage labor. You quite literally dry up. It, like, and this is just obvious. Like, if you're pursuing ever greater profits, then you need ever greater markets.
Right.
You can't. That's right. Just how it goes.
Right.
And he was quite right, and that is in fact what happened. The movement of the industrial capitalist economy to become essentially what we now call like the global economy is obvious and needs no critique here. But what's equally obvious is that we have opened up internally new markets, right? And that is to say, places in which people were peaceful and provided for had to be rendered scarce in order to create a new market for a commodity.
Mm-hmm. Or create a new fear.
Right, right. And Ivan Illich writes very convincingly about simply the profit that comes from creating managerial and bureaucratic bodies dedicated to our health, dedicated to our freedoms, that is itself the product of making something scarce that wasn't. Right, so we produce the necessity for not simply other physical inputs, but also for other law, for new forms of human life, and ultimately salaried human life.
A rational analysis of the last 250 years would be fascinating, wouldn't it?
To say, yeah.
How have we elected to go down the paths we've gone?
Yeah. I mean, what really freaks me out, as much as it freaks me out to hear anything like about the additions to food and to milk and such, what blows my mind is that a human life can be dedicated to put a person within a bureaucracy dedicated to keeping raw milk illegal, however that looks, that a whole human life and its potentiality can be produced on the basis of a scarcity that need not be. Like, you can make the necessity of someone to live as a milk cop, essentially.
Yeah, right, right.
And that's sadder, almost. Yeah, we create new roles for the manufacturing of scarcity, and then
it's deeply distressing, because once we've done it, there it is, right? And so it is real, and then it becomes difficult to take human beings, right, who live in a universe that they experience as real, and speaking as a, you know, one of those human beings who grew up in a universe that I experienced as real on some level, is it very difficult to successfully propose that thing that you're experiencing is real is not necessary.
That they're living in the cave.
Yeah, but even in the cave, things are right there chained at first.
Yes.
So things are necessary on the basis of real power structures. It's just that those power structures didn't have to happen. They're
right.
Not
well,
for God. They're
for one man. Of the things that we, you know, when the agricultural system breaks down, which again, you know, we think it's going to happen, it's going to be hard. It's going to be very hard. It won't affect us very much, but it is going to have a huge, and we're already seeing that. Fertilizers from Ukraine, they're not able to get them. That's our system right now.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen. Some food is not going to be available, or something is going to happen. And that is going to be very painful to huge cities that need that. I don't know
well,
what's going to
like
happen.
The problem with milk in particular is that we have no distribution of property in this country. Like, you have land.
Yes.
And so you're capable. But
that's right.
Even you are grazing your cattle on other people's land.
Yes, that's right.
The vast majority of people, like, the story of America, and I guess I would imagine Europe at a slower pace, has just been the destruction of private property over time. And by private property, I don't mean what like the libertarians mean. I just mean that people do not own skills, and they do not own land, and they do not have power and capacity, because those have been amassed in the hands of very few people. It's just very obvious. And so a collapse in the agricultural system will necessitate a revolution in terms of the distribution of property.
Or at least the distribution of the use of the access.
Yeah, right. What I mean, and I mean this quite simply, like if we really had that, then I think people would either have to take enough land to be able to go back to the kind of life mm-hmm. that you're talking about, or they will die.
Right.
That will be
that's right.
Or more likely, they will arrange certain relationships that will be similar to feudalism, mm-hmm. where, you know, land ownership remains somewhat large, much smaller than it is now. I mean, now it's like
right.
just insane.
But that's another way of saying people have taken it back. They've simply taken it back as a group instead of taking it
correct.
Back.
Correct.
And the problem then becomes also that this land has now been destroyed.
Yes.
Now we've got to take this land. Now, this is something that we're, when we go to these conferences and speak, people come and talk to us and they say, how do we take row cropped land?
Yeah.
That has been fertilized and all this kind of stuff. How do we turn that back into? And we are seeing a lot of experimentation from people that are starting to do this. It takes time, but it's possible. I mean, I think we're starting to see.
It's possible before it becomes impossible. There is a point beyond which.
When it's covered with concrete.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I was picturing, you know, the Arabian Peninsula, for example, and thinking, okay, so there may be a point beyond which it is not humanly possible to reclaim a piece of land. But fortunately, most of the United States, at least, does not presently fall under that heading, although some of it can be very difficult. We just did some advising at,
Georgia, Atlanta?
No, the college.
Oh, Hiram.
At Hiram College. And there's a 15-acre plot of land that they're proposing to use in regenerative ag. 14 years ago, that land was under the plow. It was part of a cornfield next to the college. It had been rented out. And when that rental agreement was, it rented out, the land was simply let rest, right, for 14 years. It is it is reclaimable, and it's going to happen faster than we deserve that it should happen if they use good practices.
If they bring animals
but
in.
You would recognize immediately what you were seeing, that a dense community of lots and lots of weeds, broadleaves, coming out of a slick clay subsoil with no organic matter on the top, except for, you know, that little bit of moss that, you know, desperately spreads itself over spaces like that. It's going to be difficult.
Yeah.
But it can be done. But it can't be done while we're relying on it for food.
Not
you
sure.
would starve in the amount of time.
Yeah,
that's right.
There
that's
has
right.
to be
that's right.
a transition period. Or
that's
else,
right.
Or else
that's right.
do die. I mean, I just think of, like, the Deuteronomical blessings and curses that are proposed by God for obeying or disobeying the
That's
law.
Right.
And he doesn't shrink. I mean, there is a point of
allowing
violence against
us.
Nature that the only thing left to eat is your own child. And that's the end point of Deuteronomy, that the only thing you have left to eat is each other. And of course the blessing which precedes it is abundance. But it is a abundance that's contingent upon our participation in it. It's
that's
not
right.
the abundance that we imagine of, like, luxury of just, like, things dropping into our mouth. It's like,
right.
become saints and you will have abundance. Become
right.
sinners.
The other thing that's really kind of exciting about what we're doing right now is, as our family gets smaller, as our children are dispersing, we are moving more and more off of the convent property. And we're moving more and more home, which is very small. We have very few acreage of pasture acreage at home.
24 acres total, but about 4 of those are pasture.
And what we are finding, which I'm excited about, is we're able to maintain our abundance on this little tiny property.
Yep.
So we're taking the methods that we moved up there with fewer animals. We're still having plenty for us. And our gardens, so the big gardens that we had up at the convent, we're moving those home. And, we are having great success.
It is scalable.
Yeah.
Totally. Oh, I know.
And so when people think, well, I've got to have a quarter section, I've got to have 160 acres, we say, no. 20 acres for a small family is
much,
even that.
Much, right.
Right.
Yeah. Half pasture, half woodland, well managed, and you have a gun.
Whatever.
Obviously, it depends on your climate. Your soil.
That's right.
But the potential is there, right? In most climates, in most soils, the potential is there for a small acres to become an extremely abundant, productive, sort of home base for a large extended family.
Yeah. And the more land you own, it starts to own you, rather than you being able to do something with it. You're spending enough time just trying to manage this, because land demands management.
I feel that way about my yard.
Yeah.
I don't think I know.
Even that. That's right. That's right. I mean, it'd be fascinating for you. I mean, we would love to watch this. How much abundance can you get from what you have, and then that little piece of property across the road, which is not, you do not own, but the owner has said to you, do what you want with it as long as you keep it mowed.
Yeah.
And I think that's, these are the experiments that I'm very excited about.
Yeah.
That what can we do with that?
Well, and depending on the food ways that you're following, I mean, King, who wrote Farmers of 40 Centuries, can't remember his initials. E.F. is Schumacher. I think there's an F in the King. But anyway, Mr. King, who wrote Farmers of 40 Centuries, was documenting Asian agrarianism, which meant almost everybody in the country.
Yep.
And it was something like an average of 2.5 acres per household, where all of the needs, and this is including things like fiber and fuel, of these families are being met, because they're not going to be met by anybody else. There's not a philanthropist next door who's going to fill in for you. Are being met from about 2.5 acres.
Wow.
And this is multi-generational families. Now, what that presumes is a level of intimate care that is unceasing.
Yeah.
That recognizes that to weigh something is to kill it, is to cast it out of the realm of the living and make it unavailable to anybody.
Yeah.
And that's a one-way street.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And since resources are finite, that's a good way to commit suicide.
Sure.
Like to do anything else. So think about that for a minute. 2.5 acres would typically support some, parents, grandparents, children, some poultry, a pig or two. It might be supporting a larger animal, but that would be typically for draft more than for milk or meat, just as a motive force. And then all the plants that were needed for to go on generation after generation after generation for 4,000 years, go on supporting the people living there.
Wow.
Kind of amazing.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
No, and I wonder. I wonder if it's not even smaller than that. Like when you care for a place, it's funny. I have this experience every time when I look at my yard in the winter.
I have to say.
Well, in the winter,
but
I look at it and I think, it's so small. How do I do anything with it? And then as things are growing and I'm in the garden, it's like the world itself becomes bigger because it's expanding in its meaning and what it's giving me. But I feel lost in it. I'm like, this is huge. This is huge.
Right.
And I think that experience is always, you know, the earth is abundant. And so it's just a question of how careful we're willing to be. I'm sure you could do it with 1 acre, but it'd have to be the right kind of life.
Right.
Well, I want to end with talking a little more about milk, or rather maybe just like doing a kind of a speed round on milk. Because we did say we were talking about milk. But the problem with milk is that, of course, as the fruit of right habit, it is about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to talk about agriculture without talking about everything. But what do you think about people who, maybe that's uncharitable, not about what people, not what do you think about the people, but what do you think about their thought? What do you think about the notion that to have milk is a sort of interruption of the calf and the mother, a kind of
I mean, what business do we have?
There's a certain and I'm thinking of like the vegans in some ways, but there's a certain violence that's presumed that we're kind of
taking
the cow away from its milk.
For our dairy cows, and our dairy cows are not super big producers, and they're all grass.
Right. Smaller breed that's not, we're not managing from.
The abundance of milk that's coming from that cow, a calf, certainly a young calf could not consume it all.
Yeah.
So we, in a certain sense, we have to be there or that cow's going to have mastitis. And these are not even huge producers. Now, as that calf grows, yes, it would come to a point where it could take all of it. But the cow is going to move to grass. Mm-hmm. And so... Yeah. The calf is going to move to grass and needs to move to grass because it's a problem for that mother if the calf, and we've seen problems like that, where the calf at a year or something like that keeps going after the mother and trying to nurse. That's
it's a problem for her.
Yeah.
You can, what makes a dairy cow isn't just that we squeeze her and get milk out of her.
Sure. Because that's every cow.
But she is metabolically inclined when she takes in calories to make milk with them as opposed to make muscle with them.
Yeah.
That's how we've differentiated between the breeds we call beef and the breeds we call dairy. Is the breeds we call beef are the ones that naturally are inclined to put calories on their backs. The ones we call dairy are the ones that are naturally inclined to put calories in their udders. And those, since those are the ones we're talking about milking, we're not interrupting any nursing relationship over here. We'll look at the dairy animals. Certainly in the commercial world, dairy calves are taken from their mothers often minutes after their birth and fed inferior foods in inferior environments with inferior care to what their mother would provide them with. And I, for one, think it's pretty appalling.
And we don't do that.
Any part of it.
Yeah.
When it is perfectly possible, and it is what we do, to calve out cows. That means mama is going through her normal life, reaches the point of parturition, drops a calf, nurses it. She'll simultaneously be added to the milking string the cows were milking. And she will, for a period of time, be milked and nurse her calf simultaneously. At some point, if what the calf is taking exceeds, it is so much that we're not getting what we need for the house, we can put the calf on a 12-hour on, 12-hour off relationship with mom. And if you want to know whether the calves object, as soon as these calves figure out that they have a private bedroom in shelter at night, they go to it. They do not need to be present to mom and nursing all the time to be happy and
healthy. We'll get one night or two nights when there's a little bit of bawling because they are used to it. But after that, that's right. After that, they are very happy to go in.
Mom, are you there? And mom leans against the outside of the barn and says, "Yeah, I'm here." And
Yeah.
Once they've decided, okay, this is okay.
So what Rousseau said about mankind, which is that the children wander off into the woods after they're nursed in the original state of nature, is more true about cows.
It is, right. people whose complaint about milking cows or milking ruminants is that it's abusive of the animals, haven't watched the animals get milked.
Mm-hmm.
Dairy calf, we can take a dairy heifer. She's 2 years old, 2.5 years old. She has not been handled by people. She's run in the herd that we move. She is accustomed to and comfortable with human proximity because we are the bringer of good things. We open gates and let her onto new grass every day. She gets bred, drops a calf. Immediately, her life is going to change because we are going to interact with her physically. The training period where you bring a heifer into the barn and begin milking her?
This is a cow that has never been milked.
Not even been handled.
No.
Right?
No, we always hope that we're going to bring this when we know that it's getting ready to calf. We think, okay, we're going to start bringing this animal into
the barn with the others. She'll get used to it. That
yeah.
Busy with other things.
That's right.
So this heifer is unfamiliar even with the barn. How long does it take, and what kind of force does it require to train her? Well, in a week, you can kind of assume she's going to go willingly into that stanchion. How many times is she going to kick you when you're learning, when you are teaching her to be milked? No. Now there are exceptions. We've had in 25 years, we have had one or two, mostly one, just bad tempered animals that did kick. But do cows object to being trained to stand at a stanchion while you milk them into a bucket? They do not.
Mm-hmm. They have a harder time going into the stanchion.
Well, and not putting having their head in there while their calf is where they can't get to it. Right.
Sure.
So what you're actually seeing is maternal anxiety quickly alleviated because you finish milking our new Turner loose and she finds her calf. The training period for that to become easy might be anywhere from 2 days to a couple of weeks. But
right.
This is not an act of violence. This is not something the animal finds deeply distressing.
Yeah.
This is a brief training period. You vegans with dogs spend more time exercising force and coercion on the dog to train the dog than we have to spend convincing a cow to let us milk her.
I mean, she wants the pressure off. That's right.
She wants the massage. She appreciates the physical contact, just as Poochie appreciates being brushed.
And the calf is not taking as much milk as needs to be taken off this cow.
Mm-hmm. Which is why, I mean, I've talked with vegans about this, and the more consistent ones argue that there should be a universal destruction of the species of dairy cow. I mean, not the species, because there's bovines, obviously, but the consistent ones say that their very existence is something that needs to be milked.
Right.
And so they advocate an ontological destruction of...
And one of the things that we would say to that is, where is the fertility going to come from for... improving the land or maintaining the land.
I just love the arguments of vegans.
No, there's
for an animal.
I know, it's like an atom bomb.
I'd like to find the vegan who is producing all of his or her own food
locally.
Producing.
Right.
Him or herself locally in an animal-free food system.
Yeah.
I am not saying that it couldn't exist, and I'm asking, I'm waving a red flag for the isolated vegan who thinks he or she is doing that to send me a nasty note saying I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that note would be intended as a demonstration that it's a viable option.
Yeah.
And I would say all year round as well, which we are able to do with our system.
Not just all year round, but I want you to be enacting this same system 10 years from now. I want to note that this is a long-term viable system. The best vegan and vegetarian farmers and gardeners I know or know of are still not using an animal-free system because one way or another, the fertility is becoming available, soil fertility is becoming available in part through animal activity. The protest that animal husbandry is somehow an abuse of animals can only be made by people whose food is coming to them out of boxes.
Out of plastic.
I mean, when you see what we do for our cows, that we move them, we provide them with water.
Who's serving
them? Yeah, that's right. They don't do work in the sense they are allowing us to take the milk from them, but we move them to a new paddock that is fresh grass. We're selecting the best paddocks. We're looking around for them. We're getting the briars out of them so that...
And one of the proofs is that if for some reason there's a time lapse after they're milked, put into their new, fresh, lush, rich paddock, they stand by the barn and tell us, like, what the heck? Where's the smorgasbord? Get down here and see to us. You can eat later.
Right.
They have a sense of entitlement. This really dear.
Yeah.
Take care of me.
Well, it does always seem that the vegan position, and it's more that I just see it as a certain heightened symbol of a general attitude, which is that we don't belong here.
I think so too. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
What I'm horrified is industrial end. You can only argue for your veganism in a complete vacuum of actual information about where that food's coming from. Mm-hmm. You cannot defend food production in an animal-free system.
Do you think that milk, or really the milk cow, teaches us about the feminine or the maternal? Or is it just sort of...
That was so funny that you just said that to... Who were you talking to? You said, my cow is one of the women on the farm. Mm. She is one of my women friends. Mm.
That is the relationship that you
have. I don't remember who you said that. You just said that to somebody.
I think it was down in Kentucky.
It might have been.
Because in some ways, it's like when you talked about...
Question again.
Well, it just strikes me when you talked about the kind of milk as being able to provide everything. There's a certain just... Of course, it's an image of the maternal. It is from mothers. And so when you're actually milking a cow to essentially receive, at least in the body, humanity's fruit, like that which nourishes. Mm-hmm. There's a relationship to the maternal understood as whatever is shared between human mothers and animal mothers, where the maternal is kind of obviously displayed as a world or a totality where you're completely taking care of others. And in that role of milk, you also have precisely the vices typical of femininity as well as the virtues, right? Which is the capacity for totalization, total control over like the child. So I think about, like, I'm trying to balance the milk as the sign of abundance, and then in St. Paul, when he's talking to the churches, he says, we fed you on spiritual milk because you were not ready for meat. And there's this dichotomy of, like, milk as the maternal sign of complete provision, but then also the sense that humanity is endangered by...
Well, I can talk provision. to the positive.
Out of that.
Yeah, I don't know that I can talk to the negative as much as I can talk to the positive, which is that as we were developing our farm and developing our practices, mm-hmm. and for a very long time we did not have good practices, mm-hmm. or not complete practices. Mm-hmm. And as we saw that the milk cow and the pasture and the soil, if we were taking care of all these, as we've already discussed, we have this abundance of food that spills beyond milk to the whole farm. We have this incredible abundance.
It gets deeper in the trip.
Right, and it's getting better every time. That sense of security, that sense of, well, of course God made it that way, that's how it would work,
right.
Overdid all of those other things that I think, especially in our day and age, distrusts or expects that the system's going to break down, that it's only going to work if man comes in and is clever and makes it work and stuff like that. Yeah, where's the catch? Absolutely. And
is that kind of what you're asking me to go?
Yeah, I mean,
but I'm not sure where that's the positive side, that sense of, wow, this really works. Mm-hmm. So when we were told, look, you just can't farm anymore, that's not true.
Yeah.
You can farm now, but not necessarily turning your farm into a profit-making machine, that may not work.
It must be connected, though, to... I mean, it just doesn't seem... I hate arguments that start like this. It can't be an accident that, when...
Yes.
Maybe it can, I don't know. But I'll do it anyways.
Yeah.
It cannot be an accident that in the same time period and culture in which we made milk illegal, and then mandated pasteurization, which is like in its most symbolic meaning is just like the imprimatur of man that says, don't worry, this stuff comes from us.
Yeah, right.
Which is that kind of illusory exclusion of the original creation, you know?
I love you putting it that way, because milk is also that thing which requires no processing whatsoever.
Right.
It doesn't even require to be chewed.
Yeah. Honey, right? As well.
Yeah.
You don't even have to chew it. An apple, at least you have to take it down and chew it. So this is like the perfect nourishment, and that we should reach out and say, you know, like fiat. You know,
transform
it so that...
Not even like it would be bettered by this process, not even that in some circumstances this is necessary, which obviously you could see, but like a totalizing, if it doesn't come from us, then you are at war with the state.
Yeah.
At some level it ends in jail. I mean, not like, I'm not saying like
the Amish
immediately, but like if you do not, you are working against...
The feds do close in on farms that are selling raw milk and holding people up to jail. It is happening.
Yeah. So that fact that at the same instance that that's going on, you have the turn to formula as opposed to breastfeeding in human life.
Yes.
And then maybe even more generally, where the same principles could be applied. It's not that there's like never a place for formula. It's not that you can't see it as a viable response to a lack. But there was, and gratefully, I think this time is well and dead, but there was a time when breast milk itself was frowned upon.
Yeah,
it was like,
that's right.
The imprimatur of man was necessary once again, despite evidence of the fact that we're still here after thousands of years. That happening alongside a just general, I don't know what to call it besides a, I don't know, war on the feminine seems kind of grandiose, I suppose. But there's the, if in the image of milk, we sort of learn something about the maternal nature, which is that the body goes on without you and provides for others without consultation, without interruption, that the body nourishes and grows. I mean, there's something incredible that women find themselves already pregnant. This has always blown my mind. It's like you're not finding that you're pregnant in the way that you would, you know,
find you have a cough.
Or you are suddenly realizing that your body is already nourishing someone. And then all the anxiety and difficulty is, how do I deal with the fact that I am already abundant, already giving, already doing something? And that seems to be like a fundamental maternal experience that I don't know that men have in the same way, although I think the reason we don't have it in some ways is precisely to be able to learn it better, because that's what our bodies ought to be doing, is always already nourishing others. But anyways, all of which is to say that it seems like this fear of the given as opposed to the manufactured, and I don't want to make a sort of like distinction there as if artifice is bad, but I mean the given and not the given cooperated with, but the given as a source of fear in our culture. It's like, oh, we didn't have anything to do with this, it must be bad. That this all has developed in our sort of late empires in the last 100 years as a simultaneous fear of the female body, fear of milk, fear of living things like live cultures, fermentations, things we can't see that go on without us, things that don't. And some of it is very comic, right? Like when we're producing the exact microbes we need to inject into the thing that we killed all the microbes from in order to get the product. It's like, what are we doing here? We are making the natural process divided into its component parts so that we can have control over each one to produce the same result and ultimately an inferior result. But the fear of the feminine seems to characterize all of this, because the feminine seems to me to just so intimately teach us about a life that goes on without us, a goodness and an abundance that we stumble upon and are surprised by. And
well, and I think it's, you know, it's abundance. I mean, the female is abundant. It could give us so many kids that's bad.
Right, sure.
We've got to control that
sure.
abundance.
Yeah.
Because that abundance will somehow overwhelm us or...
Well, it overwhelms the woman precisely as compared to the man, right? So it overwhelms career, it overwhelms that which is possible without the difficulties of abundance. Because sometimes we talk about abundance as if it's just like a rosy thing.
That's true.
There's actually nothing more frightening than
abundance of eight children. That's right.
Or,
an abundance of eight children could be overwhelming.
Say, oh no, all the tomatoes are red.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And so that inspires action and creativity and artifice.
And with milk.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of milk in our refrigerator now.
Yeah.
With the earlier question, which we didn't really hash out, maybe because it was beyond us, of, you know, like, where's the catch? I was thinking that the catch is when you try to keep it.
Yeah. You know, that's what I was trying to indicate by, like, you know, the prototypical vicious mother is the smothering mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
The one for whom that relationship, and I don't even think it's, like, I guess I mean symbolic and prototypical in almost a Jungian sense of like, I suppose men could participate in different ways, but the idea that which provides everything can turn that relationship towards itself and then fear and negate growth and life that goes away from that total provision,
mm-hmm.
right? The smothering mother. Seems to be the prototypical, or dragon mother, I think is sometimes the term. And so it seems like in the Bible, at least, you have this vision of milk as having this twofold thing. On the one hand, it is abundant, it is provision, it is a sign of grace.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it is precisely that which you must, as Christians, move beyond to arrive at meat. Like, you cannot exist in a world that isn't constantly distributing and differentiating you and pulling you further along outside of a totally closed.
As though we're naturally provided with a place of almost perfect comfort so that we can leave it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. And I think that is, I mean...
I think it's a dirty trick.
Oh, I know, it stinks.
Yes, right.
But there's also a point...
As a mother, I know that it would have been... was, you know, like my desperate desire to prevent my children being made to suffer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And thank God it wasn't one of my options, because I would certainly have been so emotionally attached to the thought of, you know, thrusting some obstacle between them
mm-hmm.
and those cosmos shaking moments that you have as a child, through small events as well as large, the moment where you perceive death,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I would, as a mother, have been incapable of stopping myself, you know, projecting myself between the child and that experience, as I would have been incapable of not grabbing them if I saw them, you know, falling into a place of danger. So thank goodness that dirty trick
is well, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, I'm trying to remember who actually says it, but the male is often, it's like the sign of differentiation. So you have this like paradox that like when children are born, women nourish them, and then men typically pretend to kill them, and it's very funny.
That's funny.
If you want to make a baby laugh, just pretend to drop it and then catch it and then laugh, because the most hilarious thing in the world to a baby is not being provided for. That's the first joke is, and that's such a great testament to humanity. Like, well, we're the kind of creatures that laughed at the thought that we're not loved. That's what it's like to be a baby. And then you learn other jokes on top of that. And it seems like there's something about agricultural work. We call it husbandry. And there seems to be something poetically related, at least, and actually related, which is that we tend to, interrupt maternal completion for the sake of new things. And so we play a sort of prototypically patriarchal role in reference to nature. So the mother is the source of the kind of fruit of the species in both the actual new individual and in the milk. And then what we do is we differentiate that. So we actually, with animals, you just described it, right? You make the separation, which we see in adult men with their children vis-a-vis the mother, that there's a, when I take the child, you're kind of predisposed to shake it up a little. I shouldn't say shake it. Goodness me.
Right. But it is who makes the exciting things happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think we teach each other both, right? Like.
I always loved that stage when the next child came, because it moved that child out of her lap and into my lap,
right?
Which was delightful.
That's right.
And then we teach each other. Edith Stein, I think, said, and I have some problems with the phrase, depending on how you interpret it, but and the whole is great. Like, if there are differences between the sexes, it is because it belongs to us to teach each other the fullness of humanity. So you distribute difference so as to learn the fullness of what it's like. And it does seem to me like the male and the female are busy teaching each other what the other needs, right? So, like, generally it seems like women need to look at things like death and look at things like the end of things and the splitting of things into newness. And then men need to learn care and gentleness, not as just like an imitation of like softness, but in the sense of like, I will be reverent towards a system that exceeds my control. I will approach this with fear and trembling to not interrupt what God has put in place. That's this mutual teaching that seems to go between men and women. Generally speaking, of course, people get mad because it doesn't relate to a particular situation,
but that's
how it is. We're teaching each other, you know? Anyways, all of which to say is it does seem like our relationship to milk does seem to mirror our relationship to the feminine and culture more generally, and maybe that's no surprise.
I think that there was a time when people read the Psalms and of the land flowing with milk and honey and did not see it nearly as figuratively as we see it now. And that you're right, that and this for us will be a discovery. You know, we're on the journey of figuring out what is the proper relationship between individual human beings, you know, or like a set of individuals and the place they reside in. But I think you're right that we will come to see that. I mean, it is the only way. It's the only way. I can't think of another. If Soylent Green is like the industrial attempt to do the same thing, it is the only way that we can reach into our living environment and draw from it daily like rich and available nourishment. And then all other things flow out of that management. And we could go on for a long time on this topic. And I'm not even going to begin to crack that one open, but I like that you've started my mind thinking, oh, this is a much bigger picture probably than I begin to grasp. I see this little, you know, I've got it by the tail, and there's a lot more to the significance of milk. And
I mean, you think about how it's also eschatologically fulfilled, that in the New Jerusalem is a mother. She's a free woman, and we nurse from her abundant breasts. We suck fully of the milk of her comfort. And so you have this in the Christian life. It begins with milk and it ends with milk, but the difference is crucial, right? Like that in the beginning, it's the milk of our own inadequacies, right? Because we are not fit for the fullness of the mysteries. Mm-hmm. So we receive the condescension of God to give us what we are capable of, but precisely because it's milk, we grow. Mm-hmm. So we become more and more capable until we're capable of meat, as St. Paul talks about, spiritual meat. And then in the eschaton, we're back to the pure reception of grace. We're nursing infants again. Mm-hmm. Only now it's through the way of knowledge. It's through the way of human maturity. It's growth into saying, at the beginning, It was all grace, and I didn't know it. And then I lived. And now at the end, it's all grace, and I know it.
Well, I know it.
And I think that's such a, I think milk, having the kind of beginning and end of the scriptures seems to make good.
I knew we were on to something.
All right. I'll do what I can. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks everyone for listening to us talk about milk. I understand that for many of you, you may not be in a situation where you can go get a cow. I get that. But do support your local hustler of raw milk, because they're there. They are trying. Human nature has never been suppressible in the main.
I could not find that person.
Yeah.
If you find them,
help them out. Buy raw milk, and we'll see you next time. Bye.